And welcome back to the MVA on Designing Business Intelligence Solutions with Microsoft SQL Server. I'm here with Chris Tester O'Neill. Sorry, Chris.
It's all right, Chris. Oh,
yeah. Pick a name. Now, we've gone through two modules already, and it's been great. And we're going now into the designing a data warehouse. Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at designing a data warehouse in the context of the overall module, as you can see, you know, we're starting to home in on specific areas now. And in this section, we're going to look at the data warehouse. So let's expand on that and home in on the specific areas of a data warehouse that we're going to look at. So in this particular module, we're going to describe what a centralized or an enterprise data warehouse is. We'll look at considerations for designing a data warehouse schema. We'll look at some performance considerations that you would want to consider when you're designing your data warehouse. How to, you know, handle slowly changing dimensions.
Very important.
Yeah, and what about integrating DQS and MDS into the data warehouse itself? So, enterprise data warehouse. When I walk into a customer, the first thing they'll say is, I want a data warehouse. Quite literally. But what I then ask them is, well, that could mean many different things. As we discussed in a previous MVA, there are many different models on which you can base a data warehouse on, Kimball and Immon. And we've said in this MVA, that we're going to focus and home in on the Kimball methodology more, simply because that's what the exam is geared towards. But, you know, we're currently in a period of massive change in data at the moment, and we're talking about this now and in the next few years with cloud and data solutions there, with, you know, big data, HD Insight, machine learning, all of this, you're going to see this rapidly change. So we're reflecting our discussion here to the focus of the exam objectives.
Of course,
people could quite rightly turn around and go, well, you're ignoring these other pieces, and we're aware of that. So when a customer asks me they want a data warehouse, my question back is, what do you think a data warehouse is? Yeah? And they'll give me numerous reasons, and it's quite varied. And the way I look at a data warehouse is essentially, you've got to deliver the data, number one. And typically, the way we deliver the data is, as you can see on the slide, using facts and dimensions, and we're looking at star schemas, which could potentially be snowflake schemas as well. Mm-hmm. So in the example that we've got here at the bottom, you'll note that here we've got a snowflake, simply because there's two levels to get to the actual fact. Whereas at the top, you've got more geared towards a star schema because it's one level to the actual fact. And you don't necessarily have to be rigid on this. You know, there are key decision points that you will make with regards to how you will do your data model. And as we go through this particular MVA, you'll hopefully understand what are the key decision points regarding the actual data warehouse itself. So we deliver the data through a data model that essentially surfaces itself as a schema within the database, and we call that schema the data warehouse. But then I also say, okay, that's great, so we're delivering the data. What happens if it goes wrong? What do you mean? Well, we're loading data on a regular basis. Who's going to look after that? Normally that's another team.
So going from design into operations.
Thinking about operations here, absolutely. And it's not, the people developing it aren't necessarily the people who are supporting it. So I want to be kind to those people. You know, we've both been production DBAs here. We've had that call at 3 a.m. in the morning. The more information we can get about that problem, if it enables us to solve the problem quicker, the business is back up online quicker, and actually I can go back to bed. So fundamentally, we have to think about a login structure that would provide information about usually the flow of data into the data warehouse. And that will cover the ETL, but it may also cover information about the data warehouse itself, such as, you know, querying for information using dynamic management views to the sizes of the tables and so forth, so that can inform you about potential maintainability that you have to do. So from an exam perspective, think of an enterprise data warehouse from a Kimball perspective. That's the way to look at it. And essentially, if we look at that, we need to home in on how we design the data warehouse schema.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And when we design the data warehouse schema, there are many different ways of doing this. But you got to think about the following points that we've got on the slide. Yeah? So, number one, is really going back to the business requirements we were talking about. Yeah, which then streams into not just technical requirements, but also what are your analytical and reporting requirements? If truth be told, most data warehouse designs are driven by the business user's need to get a report.
Yep.
And this is where data or business analysts become really, really important. If you're lucky enough to get a project team that consists of an awesome data analysis or business analysis, they are worth their weight in gold. They can save you so much time. And I've been on projects where there's been good and not so good. Because it's their job to identify the business processes. Because at the end of the day, as much as we're data people, we don't necessarily fully know the nuances of applications. Mm-hmm. You may have a sales application that if I switch the country to Denmark, I get a higher commission rate. Now, if a salesperson knows that, they're going to take advantage of that. Not all of them, but it's an application nuance that we may not be even aware of, but a great business analyst will pick that nuance up mm-hmm. while identifying the processes within the business that generates that data.
So that's data context within the different processes and
absolutely,
application.
Absolutely, because okay. we've got enough going on with the data platform layer and the BI stack, and then we've got to go to the application. There's a lot to take in. So, you know, if you're fortunate, you'll have a BA that might do step one or step two. Once we've got that, then we look at step three, which is examining the source data. And if you think about that, you know, we've got the data profiling task in SQL Server Integration Services. You have the ability to use the data profiling task to point it to a table. It will profile the data for you, and it will tell you the type of columns are in there, the uniqueness of the records, the characters, and so forth. So we can get a feel for what that source data is. And mm-hmm. Basically, again, if you've got a separate person to do this, that might end up with a data modeler creating the data model based, they're just going to create the data model based on the analytical and reporting requirements. And in the meantime, we can start to, as BI professionals, profile that data, get an understanding of source systems, because the data modeler will give you the data model. We know the source systems. We have to come up with some source to target mapping. Yeah, and what the source to target mapping is telling us is we need to get it to this data model here. It comes from these source systems here. And we need to transform it in a certain way to fulfill the business process that's been identified in here.
So where does a data model or a schema design fit within the data warehouse? Is it more focused on the business enterprise, how the structure is within the business, or more on the requirements for the application or what the reports are trying to get out of it?
If truth be told, it's a mixture of the two. Your BA's focus is business focus, yeah? They're cleverly getting the information they need to give to the data modeler to build the data model. Mm-hmm. So there's a tie-in there quite closely. But the data modeler is essentially the bridge to the development team. And it's not unusual for a data modeler to actually do the source to target documentation. That usually manifests itself in an Excel spreadsheet. No, here's your target
data
columns.
Almost,
yeah, absolutely. You're building up a data dictionary based on your target, based on your source, and then there's business logic right at the end pinned on it. I mean, if the business logic's so complex, I've been on projects where the business logic is so complex, they've see this Word document, and then you're reading the Word document for that. But what that enables you to do is to look at confined dimensions, and this can be really challenging in some enterprises, you know. Not necessarily technically, but politically, but I don't want to get into that. People have just different views of what actually sales amount means. Sales amount means something different to a finance person than it does to a salesperson. But that should be done. But ultimately, you get confined dimensions that reflect those business entities. And hopefully, you've got an agreement from all the stakeholders on what should be confined dimensions, which is the same across all the business.
So this is, again, leaning into the master data management side.
Yeah, master data management fits into this really, really well. Mm-hmm. If you've got an agreement across all the business that this is how we're going to do
what a customer looks this, like, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Then you can master that in master data services. But it still enables autonomy in the different departments. You can have some kind of mapping as you're bringing it in mm-hmm. to the data warehouse. Well, you know, antiquities in this department actually means fine antiques in the master data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can kind of give that autonomy to the departments and still bring it in.
Great.
You've also got to think about that as you've got your model, you always process data, load data in from the outer of the star schema to the fact. So there's basically, because of the relationships that may exist, you've got to load any dimension tables that are out, then the next level of dimension tables, then the fact, mm-hmm. because of dependencies with keys there.
Right.
Yeah. Document it. I know we don't like doing it, but even I do code that I forget, you know, because I've left it for 6 months, and basically have a logical schema for the database. But don't forget there's a physical aspect to this. Talk to your DBA. What is the physical implementation of that database as well? So there are things that you need to think about. And in a typical schema, what you're looking at is essentially a table that will contain what we call a business or alternate key. So in this case, we've got customer, alt key, 1002 and 1005. And we've got a product alt key of MB1B32 and MB1R32. Now, business generator keys usually change. So to build our data warehouse based on them could be a risk. Because if a business key changes and we've built logic on that key in our ETL, it will break.
So when you're saying business key, this is coming from the transactional systems?
Yeah, so the source systems, your transactional systems, your revenue earning systems may actually identify Amy Alberts as 1002 mm-hmm. and Neil Black as 1005. Now, it could be their auto-generated
identity column.
Yeah, identity column, but we may not be able to ascertain that. Because if you look at the product alt key, that isn't generated by an identity column at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we might be safe with about the customer, but I'm not really sure that the product alternate key has been auto-generated,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And then I guess it's down to the application as well, how they manage their own internal referential
Absolutely.
Integrity and all these things. So
yeah, yeah, but there's a disconnect as well.
Yep.
Just because of the nature of business, there's a disconnect.
Yep.
So let's avoid any ambiguity and create our own surrogate keys. And those surrogate keys essentially provide that level of abstraction, giving uniqueness to a given record,
mm-hmm.
and we know that it's not going to change.
Give stability to your data warehouse.
Absolutely.
Okay,
we're not going to change those keys. There will be identity columns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is something to think about. So we've got two dimensions there, customer and product. And then really, the rest of the information is very descriptive because the dimensions are providing the contextual information to your fact. Everyone's going to want to know a fact, and everyone's going to want to know what's kind of generated that fact. So, you know, we start off with Amy Alberts as a name. There's nothing stopping us from having address one, address two, city, state, postcode, everything to do that describes a customer. But your BA's picked that out. Your data model has modelled that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just have to implement it. And likewise with the products as well. So the scheme is important. What I would say is, if I think about the performance aspect, only bring back what you need. Yeah? because if you bring everything back and you don't need it, that means there's more volumes of data, which means your SIS process for loading the warehouse is dealing with more data and it's going to take longer to load in.
Mm-hmm.
So you should always start on the basis, I'm not saying it's a hard rule, start on the basis of only picking the data that you need. And that'll be a good starting point. There will be occasions where you're like, business analysts can't decide whether or not they want it or whether they do.
I'm sure this is going to be a phase two requirement.
Absolutely, yep. Absolutely. So, you know, you should really only bring back what you need.
Yep.
So, moving on. Links in quite nicely with the performance considerations, but this is an important one, and you touched on it in the last module that we did, you know, with the compression, the compression benefits that we get by using it. But this is a list of considerations when it comes to your data warehouse. File placement, yeah? Follow best practice bare minimums at the very least, yeah? Log files, master data files on separate spindles. Try and use additional NDF files, which are secondary data files, to spread out that load. It gives us the ability to essentially take advantage of the hardware that we've got. Data types. Think about the data type that you're using. Don't use the default integer data type if you've got, and you'd never use this column, by the way, but if you had an age column, you wouldn't put an age column in, but if you did, how is integer beneficial to that, yeah? Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who's older than, you know, 256, but I'm taking up 4 bytes of space just by using an inappropriate data type. If I think about it and go age, tiny int, 1 byte, yeah? No one's going to be older than 256, certainly in our lifetime, yeah? That has saved me 75% of space just by using the right data type, yeah? And I'm the son of an accountant, and my father says to me, you know, look after the pennies, the pounds will take care of themselves. And it's no different with data types, selecting your data type. If you pay that attention to detail, the collective benefit of all the appropriate data types that you choose lead to a smaller insert of data because you've picked the right one. I mentioned only use the required columns as well.
Well, from data types, there's also the other aspect, which yeah. is data type conversions. Implicit data type conversions between float, numeric, et cetera, as well.
No, absolutely. And that's a really good point because there's a lot of conversions that go on in a data warehouse. You know, so you've got to be mindful of that as well. Generally done through T-SQL. But yeah, that's certainly a point you need to do. I've mentioned that you should only use the required columns. You gave a demonstration on compression. Indexing. You know, there's people who argue for it, there's people who argue against it, but let's think about it. We won't do it in the context of column store at the minute, but just traditional indexing, yeah? At the end of the day, indexing facilitates better querying, if done correctly. But the cost of that is it can slow down your inserts, because as well as trying to insert the data into the table, that data has to go through the index structures that you've got, your B-tree structure. So there's people who argue for, no, we don't need indexes. And I'm like, yeah, I can see the benefit of that because as you're loading data into the data warehouse, we don't have that barrier to go through and we can speed it up. But what about when Analysis Services is processing its cubes? That issues a T-SQL statement to the underlying data warehouse, and it would tremendously benefit from indexes. But column store is addressing a lot of features there, isn't it, with regards to the data warehouse?
Yeah, especially when you're looking at aggregations and calculations.
Absolutely.
I mean, also, don't discount the use of filtered indexes.
Oh, absolutely.
That and it's helps you to hone in, really, on the data that you're looking
yeah,
for.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I don't want to go into internals with you because it's not the right MVA, but, if you use a filtered index, I've had filtered indexes on a number of occasions, solve performance problems. You know, if you've got 10 years of data, yeah? You've got 10 years of data. 80% of your queries are probably for the first 2 years. Why have an index over 10 years' worth of data when I could create a filtered index on just the first 2 years? It's a much smaller index. 80% of the people will be happy. The other 20%, not so happy, mm-hmm. but it's that balance, isn't it, between risk and reward that you were talking about earlier.
Great.
Partitioning, oof. Fastest method of loading a data warehouse, in my opinion. Yeah. And we don't take advantage of it enough. And you've got an awesome demo coming up with regards to that. At the end of the day, when you partition switching, you're not moving data. It's a metadata change to the partition metadata. So what, you know, here's your data being loaded in. Here's your data as it stands at the moment. You know, you may merge this data into the historical of the archive, and you're switching it across. And I'm not actually moving the data. I'm actually just changing the metadata layer on it. And that can be extremely quick. But also remember as well, don't forget about your Windows server, your hardware. They need optimizing as well. So keep on top of that. Moving on, slowly changing dimensions. There's a number of different ways you can do this. And this is explored actually on the implementing a data warehouse course. Essentially, when it comes to slowly changing dimensions, let me just take a look at the slide for a minute. There's a lot of slowly changing dimension types here, but we're just going to cover the three because it's what's covered from an exam perspective. You've got type one, right? So we're back to Amy Alberts again, yeah? You got Amy Alberts' phone number wrong. So essentially what a type one slowly changing dimension is overwriting an attribute's value. So in this case, Amy Albert's phone number is changed from 555123 to 555222.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so type one. You don't see that often in a data warehouse.
Because you're not keeping track of when or what happened before.
Absolutely, you're just correcting a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to type two, which I see in a lot of data warehouses. And essentially, we've got Amy Alberts again, and she's living in Vancouver. But what happens is, on the 1st of January 2000, so the 1st of January 2012, on the 1st of January 2012, she moves from Vancouver to Toronto. Now, you can see there in the slide that, okay, we know that Amy Alberts was there for 12 years. We know that she's moved to Toronto. There's an argument there for, do we really need the current column in there? So as you can see, we've got no and yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I could identify current records by querying for records
filtering
where the
by that.
End date is mm-hmm. null.
Yep.
Does that make sense? So that could equally be viewed as that. And look at that, I've reduced the column already. You know. But there's many discussions that can do this. But this is a very common. I need to maintain history about the individual. I have to, if you need to maintain history about a business entity, type two is a very common one. It's going to be interesting to see how this goes in the next 5 years, really, as we get new types of solutions coming in for data.
So the major thing in type two is the start and end date, yes?
Absolutely. And some people would suggest that you have a bit marker in there, like the current column in there to suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't in my solutions, but you know, if it makes you feel better about it, then maybe.
No problem.
Yeah. Finally, type three, avoid this like the plague. So fundamentally, we're keeping a track of cars. And she had a car called Zero, right? Think of it as a brand,
mm-hmm.
right? Now she's got a car called One. I think it's brand One. But I want to maintain the history. But instead of maintaining the history through inserting a new record, I'm maintaining the history by extending.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So if you were keeping track of someone's maiden name, yeah, and their subsequent married names, that would be a long table for Elizabeth Taylor, for example.
Or employment, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. So be mindful of that. So these are the three different ones that are focused on the exam. The most common one, that you see in the business place is type two. And if you go back to there's a data warehousing MVA where they discuss these. So what tool should you use? Slowly changing dimension, there is a task in SSIS. It's really good if you've never done it before. It takes you through building up the relevant tasks needed to do it. It's not really performant when you scale the data up. So invariably, I'm using some form of merge statement in T-SQL.
Great, yep. Yeah. I was about to ask that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you could do a common table expression with an insert and update statement. So you do a select to recognize all the records that need closing off. Yeah, you pick those records you closed off to insert them as new records with a new start date and new end date.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you use merge? Do you use common table expressions based on inserts and updates? You really have to test it.
Yep.
I know that sounds like a weak answer, but the reality is I've been in situations where, you know, in dev and UA team, you know, merge has worked really well, and when it's got to production, it just hasn't met the mark. And likewise with common table expressions, if you're lucky enough to get the ability to kind of, you know, change things, then you can do that.
Great.
And finally, integrating master data services and data quality services. This is actually done within the master data services configuration manager, right? So you install master data services, yeah? You install DQS through the SQL Server setup, but you've got to then run the DQS server installer, which is a command prompt that will install all the tools, create all the databases. Once that's done, you go into this...
So it's a packaged SQL Server component?
Essentially, yes. Correct. So once we've done that, we go into master data services configuration manager, and in the web configuration, as long as you've created the database and the default website for MDS, you've then got the ability at the bottom to enable integration with data quality services. Yeah, that works if they're on the same box. Okay, so from a data warehousing perspective, yeah, think about what we've discussed with regards to, you know, the modeling, limiting the data type, sizes, only bring back the data that you need. Think about how you can do slowly changing dimensions with the options of the task in SSIS, the merge, or the CT with the insert updates. And then if you're going to opt for master data services and DQS, that is a process where you've got to install MDS first, then DQS, then enable the integration.
Great.
So, one of the things that is often overlooked, in my opinion, is the ability to use partitioning and column store to help with data warehousing. And Charlie, I see you've got a demo for this, if you'd like to take us through it.
Well, yes, I do, actually. So, as Chris is saying, the our major issue is generally I/O. And what we have within SQL Server is the capability to partition your tables into different tables. And now you've got different ways to do this. Either you can create separate tables, and historically, for example, if you're going to use date as your main key for loading, because if things come in daily, it might be date that is the main thing to sort on. You might want to put completely different tables and join them together with a view of some sort. Mm-hmm. Another technology that's been available for us for a few versions, I think since 2005, and every version on version, there are improvements made to this methodology, is what's called table partitions. And this is basically SQL Server taking care of partitioning your table, a logical table, across different files and file groups.
So essentially what you're saying there, Charlie, is I've got one table, and by default, it's just in one file group in one...
Yeah, we can look at that here, actually.
Yeah.
So if we take a look... Now, this here is a report on disk usage for the AdventureWorks database. We basically get to it by going to reports, standard reports, and there are a number of them here.
Yeah.
This is within SQL Server Management Studio. So if we take a look at the disk usage report, it tells us how much data and log space we've got. Transaction log is here, used and unused. And we can go through and determine of the different file groups within our database, how much is in use, okay? So very, very interesting to look at, and something that we're going to be, you know, looking into here as well. What we looked at before was also the tables. And you can see within here, there's something here called file groups. So SQL Server very happily places data within files that belong to a file group within SQL Server. And you'll find here primary is the main file group within SQL Server.
Yeah, that's created automatically, isn't it? You can't.
It is. You can't get rid of it. Yeah. But the best practice, especially for large databases and data warehouses, is to put nothing into the primary file group.
Yeah.
The reason is when you start up SQL Server, it will not bring that database online until all the data has been loaded for that table, for that file group.
File group, yeah.
So keep it as small as possible. It can't be zero because there are a lot of system objects in there. So the idea is generally to create additional file groups. So I've got a series of scripts here, and I've done this in the background, so it's like one of those baking shows. To really leverage the partitioning and the file placement within SQL Server, the best practice is to create file groups focused on what sort of data you have, be it either on a business model or for large tables, whether it's archived data, cold data, warm data, and every customer will have different requirements as to what that means. And then to create multiple files within those file groups. That allows SQL Server to load balance the writing to those files evenly. And if you've got multiple CPUs, so we're talking, again, hardware, I don't want to get too deep into it, SQL Server can use multiple threads to populate those. So it'll really utilize the multi-threadedness of the operating system within that. So what we've got here is the AdventureWorks database. I've added a number of file groups. Okay, and we'll take a look at the database because this is now already created. So we'll look at the properties. So one is to do it via script, which is every DBA's friend. Or from the perspective of business intelligence professionals, we could probably look at it from here, file groups.
We do scripting as well, just to let you know.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, by pressing this button, right? Sorry.
That's some
low blow, low blow. Okay, so the idea is we're looking at the data that we're looking at, especially for this fact internet sales, which is deemed to be a very large table within our data warehouse in this case. As we saw before, it was 17 gigabytes. Not too big by most people, but say it was 17 terabytes. Mm. We want to say, well, our archive data isn't looked at
that often.
That's
really good, that. I like the way you've got a separate archive file group for that data that's not. Yeah.
So this, for example, could be data that we need to keep for compliance reasons.
Absolutely.
But we hardly ever report against.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
What I would generally do for an archive is make it read-only. And I'll talk a bit about what this read-only check does to a system. It actually really improves your readability and your throughput when you're looking at it. So I've decided that we're going to have four file groups for the fact internet sales. Archive, for data that we're not looking at all, pretty much. Cold, so this is data that might be years old, which is brought up once every 1 or 2 financial years for a report of some sort. Warm, we'll go to next, which is maybe the last 6 months, or data that is reported against but also isn't too hot. And then for me, hot would be the last 30 days of data, for example. Okay, so these file groups are created. Within those file groups, you can then create multiple files. So if we look at files here, what you'll see is that I've actually done the right naming, or consistently named them, hopefully. So what you'll see is that I have one file in there for the archive, because we're not really worried about performance there, and it can be just one big table, and we're happy with that. Cold, I've got spread over 2 different files, and that might be for performance, it might be because we know that sometimes that data will be read. We'll go to warm. Warm here is over 4 files, because I'm going to be placing those in 4 separate disks, possibly, or different storage types there. And I want to be able to separate them out to really leverage performance of writes and reads to those files. And then the same thing here for hot. I've got hot here over 4 files, and you'll see here that if we look at the file groups, that they actually are placed within those file groups.
And that's the thing, the hot file, so to speak, could be stored on a SSD.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. And that's, you really can, by doing this, you really can leverage the technologies
Absolutely.
Underlying to determine what's going to be on a SSD, what's on a RAID 5, what all those different RAID types, which optimize performance and readability.
So, and going back to an exam perspective, you're really thinking about the capability of the technology. You're thinking about what the business has, and you're using the technology to take advantage of what the business has, in this case, the SSD.
And we'll tie into that cost as well. Oh, I mean,
absolutely.
Here you've got the archive. You can put that on very 15K. Cheap. Very cheap disks, because you're not going to be reading off them. Nice. So commodity disks. And on your SAN, you might have another area, which is for warm. So,
which, you know, this is how, you know, DBAs talk to each other.
Yes.
But I'm really glad you're talking this, because it's given a side that perhaps as BI developers, we don't engage as much as we should do and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
Great. Now, so I've basically separated these out into different folders. They can be put onto different disk drives, etc. So that's just the technology side of it. So we'll just understand that we've created some file groups. Within these file groups, we've put multiple files. So HOT, for example, has four files, as I showed before. We've got the sizes and max size. Best practice, again, is to oversize your data files and don't shrink your data files.
Oh, I noticed file growth is zero there.
For me, file growth is zero tells me that it is being managed. So
yes.
Someone knows what the capacity is for the next 18 months. That's the best practice.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, because we don't want to have this file fragmented on disk either. Okay, because that reduces performance. So those files have been added to that file group. Same thing we've done with warm, cold.
You've done it, yeah, and the hot.
Okay, and hot, and archive.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's been done in advance, because this actually, with a setting in the operating system, because you did mention operating system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Creating these, if you don't have one setting set, will take maybe 5 hours, because it's actually zeroing out all those files.
Yeah, absolutely.
But with one setting, this will take less than a second.
Does that perform volume maintenance?
Exactly.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
So that is within the local security policy.
Yeah.
You need to grant the service account for SQL Server. I mean, we're getting too technical, but the service account for SQL Server, that perform volume maintenance tasks right. And then they will be able to use sparse files or create these files instantaneously.
Okay, so let's look at these.
So that's step one, was to make sure that we've created those file groups for partitioning. Second, we need to choose a partitioning key. So we've got, for this fact internet sales big, we've got several options. If I do a select count star, it takes 4 minutes to actually go through, traverse through the core table, and to work out what, how many rows are in there. It takes 2 minutes for this, but this, I mean, that's not very important. But if I take a look, and if I go into the right database, let's take a look at which of these two, in your opinion, Chris, would actually be the best for a partitioning key. Now, basically, I'm saying, okay, for this product key, how many rows are happening for each product key?
Yeah.
And for each order date, how many rows do I get?
So we've got to think about the data types of the columns that you're bringing back there,
The data types, and also the balance, maybe,
absolutely,
of how much data is within each of these. Because if you want a partition, you're then looking at how do I get a well-balanced tree, and how do I balance them out across the files?
Okay.
So this will come back in a few minutes. And so while that is running, let's take a look at...
How do we create a function, for example, the partition? You know, what's the next stage?
The next stage is actually creating the functions.
Okay.
So basically partitioning works off two main things. A partitioning function, which determines how to segregate the data into different chunks. And then the partitioning scheme, which then says, well, if data falls into this chunk, put it into this file group. So we'll look at that in just a moment after we've determined, or should we just step forward?
We can come back to that.
Agree to agree that the order date, I won't say disagree, we'll agree to agree, that the order date might have been the best partitioning key on this, all right? So the first thing we do is we say, okay, let's have a look at our data. We know that we have data that is older than June 30th in 2013. And in this case, in your fact table, this isn't a date column, it's an integer.
Right.
Okay. Which is actually a better representation, because it's always ascending.
Yeah, and in Dead's Warehouses, it's quite normal to have an Arda Dekki in that format because, from an interior perspective,
it's lean. It's a great lean foreign key to actually use. And actually, it's always in, ascending, and it's great for when you're also compressing.
Yeah.
Okay? Integers are wonderful. We love integers. So for dates that are less than that or earlier than that date, or transactions or facts that are older than that date, I want that to go into my archive because it's hardly ever going to be used. I've got our cold file group that we saw before. I'm thinking that within the last 12 months, or sorry, 6 months of 2013, that's cold data. We don't generally get information reports hitting that, but hey, they do come along every once in a while. Warm data, or where most of our reports or analysis is done, is within the last financial year, for example, which is 2013, end of 2013.
So essentially you're defining boundaries. I mean, without going through all
Exactly.
You're defining boundaries for the data, and which partition it's associated with.
Exactly, and the hot data is basically everything since.
So what's that as range left mean?
As range left here means that any data that is less than or equal to, okay, that basically hits that, will go into the left of that function.
Partition one.
Yes.
Perfect. So that means that if we get a date that's between the values that you mentioned for cold two, they're going to go into partition two.
That's right. And then the same for these two here. Yeah. Between here, we'll go into warm. And then greater than this, we'll go into hot. Okay? And basically, we know that this data type is an integer. So that is the input, because that's the key that we're going to be deciding where to place the data.
Yeah, so we're using an integer.
So that's the partition function.
Okay.
Okay. We need to then build a scheme on top of that function. And so as you can see here, we're digesting that function.
Yeah, okay, so there's the function.
Okay, and what we saw in that function, which you were talking about before, Chris, saying that it goes, where does it go get placed?
Yeah.
This is where it gets showed here. So it comes in here, file group archive for the left, and then, it'll go into cold for the second partition, third partition, fourth partition.
Okay, so whereas the partition function defines the boundaries, the partition scheme is telling us where each boundary maps to in from a file group perspective.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Now, keep in mind that this is the file group, not the file.
Yes.
Yeah?
That's an important
SQL distinction. Server manages that quite happily on its own.
Yes.
And this is why we created multiple files, was mainly for performance rather than anything else. Okay. And also, in case we're going to fill up a drive, we want to make sure that they're separated out so that we don't break that. Okay, so that's the partitioning scheme. So next step is to say, okay, I've got this table, fact internet sales big, and I want to move that data because before it was in the primary file group, okay, theoretically, I want to move that now into these file groups. How do I do that? Well, the best and simplest way to move data is to create a clustered index. The clustered index, technically, is the physical representation of the data.
Yeah.
So if we create a clustered index on this table.
Is that already created?
It is. This is what takes an hour.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. So this is moving everything from one table, a flat table, which is in the primary file group, into the file groups that are segregated and distributed by this partition scheme and partition function and the file groups.
And that's the key point, isn't it?
This is the magic.
It's the on clause that defines that it's using.
Yes.
Yeah.
On, and this is generally a file group name, so primary, for example, but in this case, it's the partition scheme.
Okay.
It's type scheme there. So what this will do, we're making it basically these are the only options available for it because it can't be done online. It's too big. And we're basically ensuring that it moves them bit by bit. It'll go through each row of the table because it's clustered and move it dependent on this key, okay?
So a lot of BI professionals out there will be thinking, God, this seems like hard work, and I'm used to having a table that's called fact internet sales history and a table that says fact internet sales, and I'll have some routine that will move data from the fact internet cells
manually.
To the fact, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, yeah. Manually is never a good option, right? So you want to try to automate these, automated as well.
It is automated.
Ah, so on a scheduled basis.
They'll be doing it on a scheduled basis. Uh-huh. But it's an approach that's used a lot. So I'm going to all this effort. Why? What benefit is going to give me all this partitioning?
Great. So what I can do with the partitioning here, we noticed that we had the hot file group. Yeah. The hot file group, you can actually create additional filtered indexes on there to ensure that you might under-index that during load and over-index it during reporting. What we can also do, which is a natural extension to this, is the partition switching. Okay. Now, partition switching is probably the coolest feature.
Yeah, I agree.
To do with all of this. Apart from being able to report, your load times are always very important as a business intelligence professional.
Agreed.
So let's take a look at this. I'll just clean up, just in case I've still got it. This is a demo. Great, not there. Wrong database initially anyway. So let's just make sure that they're not there. Okay, great. Wonderful. No, that's good. This is an error we're expecting.
Yeah.
So what we've got here is I want to ensure that while I'm loading, I have a way to sort of have scratch space to bring in data very, very quickly, not worry about the indexes and so forth, and then put that into our partitioned table.
Yeah, which is what you'll do. It's kind of a staging.
Staging area. Almost.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But in this case, it's actually going to be almost the same table. And when you've got a staging table, you've still got that second copy.
Second copy, agreed.
Which we're trying to avoid in this case. So what we're doing, we need to create a table, and I'm using select into here. So this is to create the structure of the table, okay, so that basically the idea is a partition to be switched needs to have the same structure as the other table that you want to switch into.
Yeah.
And secondly, have the same constraints as the table that you're switching into. So let's take a look at how this will work. So first step is to connect to the database and to create a shell table with the same structure as Fact Internet Sales Big. So I'm calling it here hot load to really show DBAs and whoever else is looking at the system that this is here for performance and because of loading purposes. Next stage is to alter that table because by default, as we saw in the properties of the database, the default file group is primary. And the only way to get partition switching working correctly is to ensure that it's within the same file group, because then it can internally do just a metadata change to say that this table, which is in this file group.
And that's the key point, isn't it? It's a metadata change.
Yes. So that's, we're not actually moving,
not moving
data. So we're basically, it's almost like SQL Server knows that it's being tricked.
Yeah.
And it's giving us an opportunity to trick it into saying that this table is now actually this table.
Yeah.
So let's take a look here. So we're altering the table by adding a constraint, which is actually a clustered index, like we did before, to put this table into the FG hot file group. Okay? And it goes through. There's no data in there anyway, so there's no data to move. And this is why we do that at this stage rather than later on. We don't need that index anymore because we want a fast load. So let's drop that index.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing here is actually just importing data. So I've got basically, this is just for demo purposes, pretending that I'm bringing in data in for today. Okay, I'm finding the last set of data, which is 20 days before the last load, just so that it's representative. And I'm basically using the Fact Internet Sales Big table to basically import another day's worth of data. Okay, so let's run that. So this is what we're hoping will run quickly as part of our normal day-to-day loading process. And we've loaded in 112,000 rows within 3 seconds. I mean, that's on our, it's not representative, of course, but it's a virtual machine, etc. But this is what we're trying to achieve. The faster we can get our loads working into this table, the better. Now, in order to use the metadata switch. We have constraints, and there are a lot of constraints actually to ensure that it works. Because we have already partitioning involved in our process, we know that it has to be to the right of that hot data partition. So greater than this date. So SQL Server has to be assured that we're not actually spilling other data in there as well. Okay, so partition switching will only work if you've got a constraint that also represents this side of that function. Okay, so this is where we're creating a constraint on order date key to say that it has to be greater than or equal to that date.
Yeah.
And you know, today's date is greater than June 30th, 2014. Okay, so let's create that constraint for that first level requirement. And the second is that it needs to be ordered the same way as well, because we've got a clustered index on that partition. Okay, so let's create a clustered index.
And is this all the prep work done then?
This is it. So this can actually be scripted. No, well, this is actually going to happen every time you do the load.
Yeah.
So you'll have, as part of your sys package, for example, these two statements as well to ensure that it's ready. And then the last step, okay, you saw that it took 3 seconds to do that other thing. It took 1 second to create the clustered index here.
Yeah.
If we could measure milliseconds, that's what we'd be looking at for this switch. Now let's have a look at the syntax here. We're altering the table, the hot load, and we're switching it to fact internet sales big in the fourth partition, which is the partition we saw within the function, the partition function. We have to be very sure and that we know which partition that is, because it has to meet the constraint criteria.
So it's, well, we're looking at about 120,000 records here. Yeah, it was
112,000, that's right.
And it was 3 seconds before. Let's see how long this takes.
Okay. Now, stopwatch is at the ready.
Go.
Okay. Ah, data compression. So we had compressed that before, and actually this is a very good indicator.
Yeah, it is,
The requirements are that the schema is exactly the same. The data is exactly the same. So let's go back, drop that clustered index, drop constraint. Well, let's clean it up again. Just so that we save time.
Yeah, it's clean. I'll just run through it.
So what we need to do is to make sure that the clustered index that we create on hot load also has our compression setting. So let's take a look. That is with data compression page. Okay. So let's go here with, and we'll put in here. So we don't need that. We don't need that. Comma.
Yeah, looks good. That looks the same now.
Alrighty. So we'll go through these steps again. We're creating those tables, adding the data in there.
Yeah.
Creating the check constraint and the clustered index.
Yeah, good.
So that should take around 3 to 4 seconds.
Yeah.
Maybe
I'm
five.
Glad that happened, actually, because it made the point with regards to the fact that they have to be the same. So.
Yes. So the underlying on-disk structures have to be exactly the same.
Okay. Stopwatch ready this time, That was a...
So what we're doing here now is doing the switch. If there are no other changes in there, we'll see if it works. Now, data compression is set again. This may be because I have set column store indexes on that full table.
Okay, can you drop that? Or would it take too long?
It would take too long to do the next part of the demo.
Okay. So I can assure you I've seen this work before, not just with Charlie, but other ways. There's really good the prep work that you have to do. But I can confirm that it would have taken less than a second to do that. This is the quickest way you can move, quote, unquote, data, and taking advantage of the SQL Server features there is what designing is about. Understanding the capability and taking advantage of it to the benefit of the business.
Agreed. Now, the basis of this was actually that it was under a row index, a clustered row store index. Now, the next step was to look at column store, and it's just a very quick, a very simple statement.
So what's column store?
So column store is basically a new method of indexing, which came out based on the VertiPack technology in SQL Server 2012. In 2012, we had non-clustered column store indexes, which were not updatable. So we had to actually switch out, take the index offline, and update it, etc. Now we have clustered column store indexes. Now, if you look at it, a row will have a lot of data for a transaction or an event with different data types within it. A column store index switches it. It pivots that whole model completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it works really well for reporting and business and intelligence and analysis because we're generally aggregating on a column.
Yeah.
So total sales, for example.
Yeah.
So if we're aggregating or we're partitioning something on a column, we can actually go through that very, very fast. And the way this works is that it uses compression inside because the data type is the same. And generally, the data inside will be the same.
Yeah, and it's using a raw length encoding algorithm as well. But you might want to bing that and look for the white papers there.
Because
definitely. Quite very in-depth.
There is a lot of information on... there's a lot of it.
So basically, this is just one statement that we can see.
It is. And if you take a look here, this is the normal clustered index that we created before. Okay, with the partition key. And the difference is that you do not put in a field for the clustered index because the physical representation is now each column within the table.
Yeah.
Okay, so all it is, create column store index on table name. Okay, and in this case, where we're partitioning or where we're placing it is still using the partition function.
Yeah.
Okay, so that allows us, again, to distribute that data within the file group.
And I'm really glad that you're putting the time at the bottom line. So that would take 35 minutes. On
gives us the indicators,
Because you've got to think about these things when you're loading the data warehouse. This is my schedule that I've got to fit it in. You know, creating a column store index there is going to take 35 minutes up before I can even begin to process it.
Yeah, keep in mind though, this is the first time. So this is the one-off.
Yeah.
You can always, when we're talking about maintenance later on, all of your maintenance tasks can be done partition by partition.
That's good. Yeah.
So that's one of the other benefits of using column store here. And that's the end of the demo, actually.
Okay. So thank you very much, Charlie, for that. It's been insightful to see you setting up the partitioning and looking at the column store there. We'll be right back after lunch where we will continue with the designing BI solutions with Microsoft SQL Server MVA.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.